Good morning and welcome. I'm Christopher Purdy, live in the studio for today's edition of All Sides Weekend Books. And it wouldn't be a show without Cassie Rose, who is WOSU's book critic and an expert on books worldwide, and Kevin Griffith, who is professor of creative writing and others at Capital University. I welcome you both and thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
This is, for better or worse, election season. And people are so inundated with TV attack ads that I bet they're reading more. They're turning off the TV and they're reading more because they can't stand to see one more of those commercials. But Cassie Rose walked in today with a very large book by Robert Caro about Lyndon Johnson. This is, I think, one of a multi-volume series he's written. And it's a large book.
Lyndon Johnson,
The Passage of Power.
Yes.
Let's talk about what it was like to campaign 50 years ago.
Well, it was very different because they didn't have television, for one, but also the politics were different. So that to get the delegate votes, for example, for the convention, which the election with Kennedy versus, I think it was Nixon in 1960.
Yeah. You weren't there, but I was. I remember. Yes.
To get the delegate votes, back then it was all about friendship, and it was about sending Christmas cards to the delegates and the influential people and going to dinner with them, which is why Lyndon Johnson failed to get the nomination, because he thought it would be all about the senators. And he was very, very powerful in Washington at that time as the Senate Majority Leader. So he was banking on the fact that they would get to the convention and there would be a lockup in terms of the delegate votes. Now, here's another thing that's different, is that conventions that many years ago determined who the candidates were, whereas now it's just a rubber stamp. So they didn't know whether it would be Kennedy or Johnson, Adlai Stevenson, Humphrey, and a couple other candidates. So they really had to work for the votes, and Johnson underestimated the power of the Kennedys. He really thought that the vote for the candidacy would be thrown into the back room with the big bosses, where he had all the power and that he would get it. But Kennedy came up with all of the delegate votes that were needed. And then it became the choice for the vice president that was chosen then at the convention. And Kennedy selected Johnson because he could bring in the Southern votes. And Johnson thought that power is where power goes, and thought that as the vice president, he could maintain his power. But he was greatly misguided on that.
I believe the latest volume of Caro's series has recently been published. So these are large books, long books.
Are they
riveting books, or are they dry politics?
This is The Passage of Power is the most recent, and it is riveting. I chose this book because of the time frame, 1958 to 1964, which fascinates me, because I knew also that it would be about the Bay of Pigs, about the Cuban Missile Crisis. It also is about the assassination of Kennedy. And it's riveting because Caro knows how to bring the drama in. He does have all of the political details. He shows you how power works in Washington. He describes the personalities of Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, how they worked with Johnson and against Johnson. So you get this human drama along with the politics, and he does an excellent job with that. So it's a daunting book because it's 600 pages in small print, but I've been reading it about 10 to 20 pages a day, and I look forward to it.
I do that with Dickens. Terrific. Yeah. That's wonderful. It's good to know. It'll be fun later to talk about political novels and political books as we get further into this rather depressing political season. All I can think of right now is The Last Hurrah, which is my favorite political novel, which is 70 years old because it's based on people I heard about growing up. So scandalous and fun at the same time, Last Hurrah. Mm-hmm. Kevin Griffith, how are you? What do you have for us? How are your politics today? Never mind.
It's not politics so much, but it was interesting. Cassie and I were talking right before the show that Cassie's had to sort of dip back and go back to find a really great, meaningful read this summer. And we were talking about sort of the lack of a fiction with gravitas this summer. It's very hard to find that, and how a lot of fiction seems to be superficial and not very ambitious. And it's interesting, she went back to Caro, and I went back. Probably the best book I've read this summer, I didn't bring it along, I didn't think I needed to because I remember it very well, but the best book I read this summer was a reread. I went back and read Sophie's Choice by William Styron. And I think I hadn't remembered what a funny book that was. It's a delightful book at the beginning.
Yeah, one really
yeah. Yeah, it's the first chapter when Stingo is the main character, right. But it's obviously Styron. Styron talking about his work in the publishing industry and the advertising industry. Very, very amusing, riveting voice. And that novel, I think anybody who reads fiction these days and has the audacity to do what we do, review it or go on a blog and review it or anything, ought to go back and read Sophie's Choice by William Styron, 1979, not that long ago, mm-hmm. to see how high the bar can really be set in fiction, because I don't think we've touched upon anything here that's even come close to it recently. I've had a hard time finding it. I think there was a really famous quote in a book I read that said, really, you shouldn't read good books because they'll only remind you how bad most of the other stuff is. And I've had that feeling a lot this summer. It's been kind of hard to find the really great, ambitious book.
Well, clearly, Kevin, you're not reading the New York Times bestseller list, because 1, 2, 3, 50 Shades of Grey, 50 Shades Darker, and 50 Shades Freed. And then Gone Girl, which I understand is a wonderful novel. People say that's a really riveting novel by Gillian Flynn. Those are the first four entries, so three by one author, and then Gone Girl mm-hmm. on the current New York Times bestseller list. I think the good books are out there, but they're harder to find because they're mm-hmm. not promoted.
Right.
You know, you have to really dig through library shelves and mm-hmm. things like that, but very seldom does a book you describe land in your lap. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. It makes you appreciate how rare right. the rare this occurrence
in this,
is.
In this era of too much information all the
time. Well, I think also that there's a partnership that's going here that is sort of the snowball that's gaining force and rolling down the hill, which is, one, you have the publicity and the top publishing companies in New York that are just looking for those authors that will satisfy the consumer need. And so then there are the writers who are writing to that need, whether it's, you know, vampires or sex, violence, you know, the quick read. And Kevin was saying that how he had read, or we were discussing about, books can't be more than 250 pages because people won't read beyond that. And so all of this, I think, is gaining force to just publish books that are on the surface that aren't very ambitious and aren't of the high quality of literature that was Sophie's Choice. But beneath all of that, I think it is still going on. It's just, again, as Kevin has said, or you have said, that it's not apparent to the busy, everyday consumer. They can't go on to Amazon or Barnes & Noble. They can't walk into the Barnes & Noble stores and find the excellent literature that is coming out. And also there's the loss of a lot of book critics in the newspapers. So this gaining force really becomes, in my eyes, a form of censorship, because it prevents the readers. It doesn't give them access to the readers, access to the books that they could choose and browse, which you would find at independent bookstores.
And if there were more of them.
There were more of them. So again, there's the onus on the, in fact, I did write sort of a blog post about this, the onus being on the reader. I gave a list of the best books we've ever read that was 100 crime novels put out by Partners in Crime Mystery Booksellers. They're closing, an independent bookstore closing in the West Village. And I found this book list, and it's 100 great books, classics. They've kept it updated for years. And then I pose, though, the question of, you have 100 books here. How do you choose which one is going to work for you? And you have to do the research now. So, and consumers, readers don't have the time for that.
Well, first of all, I want to invite people to participate in the discussion, 292-8513. You can send an email to allsides@wosu.org, or you can find us on Facebook, 292-8513. We want to know what you're reading, what you recommend, even what you didn't like much. But I've been reading several heavy books lately, and the one I'm in the middle of now is about the Shroud of Turin, and it's fascinating. It's really magnificent. But halfway into it, I was never so happy to grab Dominic Dunn in my life. I mean, because you need to escape and enjoy, and he's perfect mm-hmm. for that. Any mm-hmm. of his novels are great for that. I mean, I'm all for sort of guilty pleasures that I don't really feel guilty about much anymore. Stairmaster books, you know. Mm-hmm. I tried reading a heavy book on the Stairmaster. It doesn't work because I'll just get right off of it and go back to bed. So I would love to hear about people's favorite guilty pleasures and also whatever you want to talk about, whatever you're reading now, 292-8513. Kevin and Cassie both come in here, thankfully, with stacks of books. Kevin, what do you have on your
We'll go to a really great read that did just come out, 2012, this summer. And this is actually for middle-age readers, meaning middle school, younger kids. But it's a great book that you can read with your kids. It's called Summer at Forsaken Lake. What a great title. Summer at Forsaken Lake by Michael D. Beale, B-E-I-L, Beale. He is a English teacher at a Catholic school. That's what his bio says. But this is a great book. This is a book that's set near in Ohio, on a lake in Ohio. And it's about a boy whose name is Nicholas Medelson, and he has to go live with his uncle Nick, who lives in this huge Victorian house right at the edge of the lake and has a boat, a sailboat, the Goblin. And he's there with his two twin sisters, and it's a great book about what summers used to be. It's set in contemporary times, but of course there's no cell phone service in this area. You can't do cell phones. There's no computers. Kids are expected to go out and find something to do every day. So they go through this old Victorian house. They find this secret love letter that was written to their father because their father used to live there many years ago. Written to their father. That starts a mystery. They find a little 16-millimeter film that their father was working on. Their father is actually working for Doctors Without Borders in Africa at the time, so he's not there. But it's a wonderful book about waking up every day, working on a sailboat, finding this film, trying to figure out how this film was made and how they can finish the film. Beautifully written. This person is an elegant writer who knows how to develop characters. Wonderful read. I read it. My daughter read it. My wife is reading it now. It's called Summer at Forsaken Lake. If you really want to remember what summers used to be like, without all the camps and everything else and the computers and all that other stuff.
When kids actually went outside.
That's right. You got outside, you rode your bikes, and every day was an adventure.
Right, yeah.
This is the book, Summer at Forsaken Lake. Probably one of the best reads
that's a great idea to have people. Let us know if you have a book that you've been reading with your kids that would resonate with you and with the kids itself. Because that's a good. I mean, I read to my daughter from the time she was tiny, and I'm convinced she read early because of that. So I'm big about reading to your children, but reading with your children like a little mini book club. They'll roll their eyes and think it's ridiculous, but right. it's fun to do. We have to take a break. We'll be back in 1 minute. Please call us 292-8513. We've got some people waiting, but we also have some lines open. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. Back in 60 seconds.
When Paul Ryan was selected to be Mitt Romney's running mate, we enjoyed a period of time when we were able to debate the big ideas at stake in this election. And then after about an hour, everybody got bored and started calling each other unhinged. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we do our best to debase the debate even further on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, tomorrow morning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. 72 degrees with cloudy skies, some sunshine later today and a high of 78. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 53. Sunny and a high of 75 on Saturday.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, wrapping up the seventh season of Jazz Zoo with That's Entertainment, Byron's Birthday Bash, featuring Tonight Show legend Pete Barbuti and other musical guests, Friday the 17th at the Zoo, jazzartsgroup.org.
All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you, Amy Jurevich. I'm Christopher Purdy, back with Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith. We're talking about books on today's edition of All Sides Weekend. You can call us at 292-8513 or send an email to allsides@wosu.org to get into the conversation. Cassie, you have a book there by Edward St. Aubyn. And the reason that I'm curious about this book is that I've been on the Whetstone Library waiting list for this book, or want a book like this by him, for about 2 months.
Which is unusual.
At last, yes. So I read one of them, and he is riveting. But can you give us, just fill us in, why is the waiting list so long? Who is this guy?
Well, I think it's so long at this point because he's finally hit the radar screen. He was not well known with his first novels in what's called the Patrick Melrose series, which is Nevermind and Bad News. Those are the early novels. But I think he's now hit it. And I think Downton Abbey has helped with that because he skewers the British aristocracy. And he's also been highly interviewed. And At Last got big reviews. So a lot of people have gone in to read At Last, and now they're wanting to go, which is the last book
in the
series.
That's what I just read, right.
So, yeah. So you just read At Last?
The Mother's Funeral, yes.
Right. So when I was reading all that, I thought, I want to start back at the beginning. Mm-hmm. About when Patrick Melrose, who is the main character in these books, is 6 years old or 5 years old. But to give a little bit of an overview, the Patrick Melrose novels are based on his experience. I mean, he's not writing a memoir, and this is not creative nonfiction, but he is from the British aristocracy, descended, you know, from probably barons and dukes and all of that, which is what his characters are, and he's going in and just skewering them. And he also, I mean, Patrick Melrose, this one character, is sort of his fictional version. Mm-hmm. And why he's, you know, hit the popularity list. I mean, I'm surprised the waiting list is actually that long, but it certainly tells, I think word of mouth is also going out about this. Anyway, I decided not to read At Last, but to start at the beginning. So, and Picador has put out this wonderful edition that is very accessible. I mean, it's four novels in one, and it's much less daunting than the LBJ book.
Yeah.
So, and I've read Nevermind and Bad News, which are the first novels.
Now, just give us a quick premise. Why is Patrick Melrose interesting?
Again, it's because I think of the British aristocracy. And in the first book, he is 5 or 6 years old, and it takes place over a day in their French country home of the Melroses. I mean, it's like a town and country place. But the thing is that these people are really appalling. They're very rich, but they are alcoholics, they are pedophiles, they are drug addicts, they are social tyrants. And so you know that because St. Aubyn is coming from this arena himself, he's writing from experience. And he will say that, except that he says his intent is to create art, not a confession. So in the first novel, there's a dinner that is happening. It happens over one day. But there is also an incident that happens to Patrick Melrose that is appalling, and it actually happened to Edward St. Aubyn. I don't want to give it away.
No, don't give it away.
But the beauty
appalling's
then,
good
right,
enough.
The beauty then of reading it in this version of all of the novels together, I finished Nevermind and immediately turned the page and went to the next novel, Bad News. I can't imagine what it was like to have waited a year, because in Bad News, Patrick Melrose is now 22 years old. He's going to New York City to collect the ashes of his father, who died in New York. And Patrick is a horrendously addicted cocaine and heroin user. And of course, you know, he's taking off his gold cufflinks, rolling up his sleeves, and shooting up in the Pierre Hotel.
In the Pierre Hotel,
yes.
God forbid the Motel 6, right? Yeah.
Right. Okay. But you see him also, you know, kicking the lamp and kicking the trolley of food. And on the one hand, you see this misery, but on the other hand, St. Aubyn is hilarious.
It's very funny.
It is very funny. And it reminded me of The Slap.
Yes, yeah, we talked
because,
about that.
Yeah, The Slap, because he's showcasing a way of life, and while it is appalling and it's horrible the way these people are behaving, but at the same time you're riveted because he is of the irony of the way that his commentary on them, you laugh out loud.
So what you have there are the Patrick Melrose novels in one volume.
The four of them.
The four of them by Edward St. Aubin from Picador. And that is a worthwhile read based on the one that I've read. And he is very savagely funny.
Funny. So are you going to go back?
I am.
And start at the beginning?
I am. Yes, I am. I'm going to, now that I've spoken to you and seen them, yes, I'm going to do that. We have two emails, one from Sarah. I read Gone Girl this summer. I couldn't put it down. Each chapter ended on a cliffhanger and made me want to turn the page. And I love a book that makes me want to keep reading. Me too. And Sarah, you're not the first person who's described Gone Girl in this manner. So, I mean, it's a bestseller for a reason, you know. Debbie wants us to know my best read in a long time, The Watchers by John Steele. Hard to describe. It has everything: mystery, fantasy, religion, real life places and history, as well as character development. Highly recommended. And we have Terry from Youngstown on the phone with a recommendation. Hi, Terry.
Yes, I read in recent months one book is called The 12 Mighty Orphans, written by, his last name is Dent, and it's a history book. It's a history about the early days of football in Texas, and it's a true story. Oh. It's really good, and it's a cliffhanger at every chapter, and the writer puts you right on the football field, play by play.
It's a novel?
It's a novel,
okay.
Right.
All right.
And my other one I read was Warmth of Both Suns, and it's dealing with history again, but about the black community going from migrating from the south to the north after World War I. It's really good. Both are really good books.
Let me repeat the Warmth of Both Suns. Is that what the title is?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Terry, for the recommendations. Yeah. Good to talk to you. 292-8513 is the number. All sides at WOSU if you'd like to send us an email. And as I've said, you can also find us on Facebook. I don't know about The Watchers by John Steele, but I'm turned on, frankly, by Debbie's description of it. And Gone Girl Gone, again, is a huge seller, and people are really eating it up. But let me ask Kevin, who is Jack Gilbert?
Oh, well, let's get to something that, before we get to my guilty pleasure for the summer here, a good mystery, I would like to mention Jack Gilbert. If you are looking, and we talked about rare events here, where you actually find a person of national literary reputation, and this would be the poet Jack Gilbert. If you're looking for a book of poetry to buy for a gift for someone, or just to read yourself, something you could actually read from first page to last, like a book, it would be Jack Gilbert's collected poems. Gilbert is now 87 years old, still alive. He's published only 5 collections of poetry in his lifetime. He won the Yale Younger Poets Award in the very early 60s. And the National Book Award he's won. 5 books, so that's about 5 books over 50 years. To me, that's a sign of a good poet. You're not over-publishing, you're taking your time. And he is a wonderful poet, often not on the radar, not in the big anthologies, but he's a wonderful, wonderful poet, plain-spoken, not afraid to deal with the really big questions, the questions of religion, death, and in the most plain-spoken way. I'd like to read just a little bit of one of the poems, just to give you a sampling here. This poem is called Tasters for the Lord, and I'll just read you the last part of the poem. We go into the secret with the shades pulled down at dawn, like a house on fire in sunlight. We enable God to finally understand there is a difference between you sitting in the clearing confused by moonlight and you sitting in the bare farmhouse amid the kerosene light, the two of you. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good, I don't know what the poem's exactly about, and that's also the sign of a good poem, but this is dealing with how, you know, we go through life with different identities, and in some ways we're kind of like the tasters for the Lord. We do that. We taste experience, and that's what our lives are all about. He just has wonderful poems. Probably his most famous poem is called A Brief for the Defense, and it's a very interesting poem. It's just defending, it's a great topic for a poem. It's defending being happy while the rest of the world is sad and dying. I'll just read you the beginning of it. It's very good. Sorrow everywhere, slaughter everywhere. If babies are not starving someplace, they're starving somewhere else with flies in their nostrils. But we enjoy our lives because that's what God wants. Otherwise, the mornings before summer dawn would not be made so fine. you know, and it continues. But that's what poetry is supposed to be about, those arguments we're afraid to make and can't quite articulate.
It provokes you, yes.
Yeah, Jack Gilbert collected poems. If you really want to introduce yourself to a great poet, I would recommend it.
Now, after Flies in the Nostril, you have to tell us your guilty pleasure.
Oh, okay.
Just do.
We'll go. Well, we talked about mysteries. And Cassie mentioned great mysteries. And, of course, you know, I love a good Scandinavian mystery. And here's yet another Scandinavian mystery writer. There's a million of them, so I try to look through a lot. But this person's called Anne Holt. She's from Norway. She was actually the Minister of Justice in Norway for a while, for a time. She's an attorney. And this is a book called Blind Goddess. It's a Hanne Willumsen novel. The protagonist is a lesbian detective in Norway. And she is a really good writer. And this is a very good traces of humor in the novel. Two engaging characters. Hanne Willumsen is very good. And she's working out a pretty complicated mystery, but you never get lost. That's what I hate when mysteries become so weighed down with all these loose ends that you just lose your way and you can't even finish it. This one I actually wanted to finish. Very good atmosphere in the novel as well. You get a real sense of sort of the claustrophobic nature of a detective trying to piece together this, what turns out to be a massive corruption ring among attorneys, a drug corruption ring in Norway itself. But she's just a very good writer. She knows how to write. And when you talked about Gone Girl, we shouldn't be too dismissive of Mm-mm. popular fiction. Mm-mm. It takes real talent to write a page turner. And I think we should make note of that. And Anne Holt is definitely of that ilk. She can write a good novel. And she knows how to tie all the ends together. Blind Goddess, it's called, by Anne Holt.
Have you read anything of hers before?
No, I hadn't. I just stumbled upon this again at Whetstone in the new book section. Began reading it. Usually I'll begin reading a mystery, mm-hmm. and if something puts me off real soon, I'll just abandon it. I didn't do it with this one. I followed it all the way to the end. If you're a book lover, I won't want to give away the ending, but the ending depends upon these codes written in children's books. So it's really interesting the way mm-hmm. she puts that together. Very clever book. So Anne Holt, Blind Goddess. This was actually written in 1993, but it's been re-released.
Cassie Rose, I have to ask you what your guilty pleasures are.
Oh, my
the
guilty.
The books that you choose to rest over or just sort of have fun with.
You know, actually what I have been doing recently is going to mystery books. I mean, I did read Gone Girl. I mean, that for me was a little bit too much. I need a little bit more than what Gillian Flynn had provided there in terms of character development. But I turn to these detective mysteries. Peter Robinson has been one that I have been following, and I started with his first one. I think I've read his second and third. You know, British detectives that, you know, there's something that happens. They've got to go find, you know, what's going on. I don't like them too dark because this is my guilty pleasure kind of thing. I like, you know, something going on with them personally. And, you know, either they're fighting with their wife or, you know, problem with the kids. So I love hooking into that British detective. And just for me, I know that they're going to solve the murder and it's going to wrap up all in the end. So I sort of, that's what I relax into.
So you're not going to be reading Joan Rivers, Men Are Stupid and Like Big Boobs? Or
no. No.
Okay, you're not going to be reading that. Well, all right then.
But it has to be a page turner, though.
Yes.
I think that's the mystery part of it, because I can let go.
Yeah. 292-8513. What are your page turners? All sides at WOSU.org. People are sending us a lot of email, which is nice, and they'll be printed off and coming in throughout the hour we have together. I'm Christopher Purdy, talking about books with Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith. And if you want a great mystery to read, The Sign by Thomas de Wesselo, which is about the Shroud of Turin. It is not a book about religion. It's a book about archaeology. And it, too, is a page-turner, but you might have to, around page 200, relax into a little Dominic Dunn or someone like that just for the afternoon, I'm telling you. But it's a wonderful book. Now, you have a compelling, it looks like Boris and Natasha there, Kevin Griffith.
Oh, okay. Yes. Well, we went from poetry to guilty pleasure. Now we go to something incredibly weird.
If you look.
if you're just tired of the usual stuff, and you want to go, this is from a small press. Let me see the name of the press. I forgot. Yes, Chomo Press. But this is "I Am a Magical Teenage Princess." This is a collection of short stories called "I Am a Magical Teenage Princess" by Luke Geddes. Luke Geddes is a brand new writer. This is his first book. And it's not, it says in the end that he has an MFA and he's working on his PhD at Cincinnati, but this is not your usual MFA type fiction, I will tell you. It's not Raymond Carver type realism. Almost every story in this book is based upon a vintage television show. So there's one called The Modern Stone Age, which is looking at the dark side of the Flintstones and what they were doing off the set. There's one, my favorite one in here, and let me get to it, is And I Would Have Gotten Away With It If It Wasn't For You Meddling Kids, which is based on Scooby-Doo, and it's written from the point of view of the villain in the Scooby-Doo, who's very world-weary. His goal in life was to open a Native American theme park. That didn't quite work out, so it's going to shut down. And he sees them approaching, and he comments sort of on what they're doing, and, oh, this is great. Here's the jock with the redhead, and, of course, you know, and he has to get up the energy to actually go and scare them. And so he's saying, like, and so I'll get down on all fours and make some growling noises. And it's very, very, very amusing. There's another story, too, called He's a Rebel, about the James Dean rebel yeah. without a cause type of genre. And what's happened is it's set in the future, and they've rounded up all the rebels. The U.S. government has put them all in these rebel internment camps. But one escapes, and, of course, he escapes and immediately defiles the reputation of two young girls, and it's written from their point of view, and they keep fighting about who the rebel's going to take, and you know, he's eventually hunted down by the authorities and taken back to the camp. It's called I Am a Magical Teenage Princess by Luke Geddes. If you're looking for something very fresh, amusing, it's not Sophie's Choice, that's for sure. but if you want something that'll keep you very amused for a couple of days, and it is a fine, well written, I must say.
So he got his degree having
yes.
Yeah, okay.
This is probably written for his thesis or something, but it's a wonderful, wonderful book. And the one thing we don't talk about a lot on this is small press. They have very good standards for layout and design. Excellent cover here, good typography, a well-produced book, a nice rare thing to have a good book in your collection that looks good. It's intriguing. I Am a Magical Teenage Princess, Luke Geddes, G-E-D-D-E-S, Luke Geddes.
Let's try to have, we'll see if we can have him on the show with us and talk about books that are weird, because weird is good. We like weird.
Okay. Yeah, we should. That'd be really great.
I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend. We're talking about books. We have some calls waiting. We will get to you as soon as possible. We have some emails coming in. Cassie Rose is here. She is WOSU's book critic, and her blog is called The Longest Chapter. If you want to know in a quick and pithy way what is good to read, check that out. Kevin Griffith is here from Capital University. And now that we're here, we're going away for 90 seconds for a break. Don't move.
On the next Fresh Air, Sacha Baron Cohen talks about his comedy The Dictator, in which he plays the corrupt, tyrannical ruler of a fictional oil-rich nation in Northern Africa. It's out on DVD next week. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And the Fab Four is undoubtedly the ultimate Beatles tribute. With uncanny note-for-note live renditions of the Beatles classics, the Fab Four will make you think you're back in time, rocking with John, Paul, George, and Ringo. Join WOSU TV Sunday night and hear songs such as Can't Buy Me Love, Penny Lane, Here Comes the Sun, Hey Jude, and many more. Watch the Fab Four Sunday night at 8 on WOSU TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. Information about how Montgomery & Associates can help you achieve your financial goals is at themontgomerysolution.com.
73 degrees in downtown Columbus, a mix of sun and clouds today with a high near 78. Clear skies tonight and actually a little chilly, a low of 53. Sunshine and a nice day on Saturday with a high of 75. Sunny and a high of 75 again on Sunday. All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are back. I'm Christopher Purdy with Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith talking about books. And Janet has been waiting patiently on the phone. Janet from Pataskala. Hello, Janet.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I always love your programs.
Thank you.
I have a book which I found in my garage when I was cleaning up. I've never read it. It's called The Horse Boy by Rupert Isaacson. And on the front was a picture of a little boy on a horse that was laughing and a man on the horse. And I said, oh, my little granddaughter would love this. So I took it to her. And 2 days later, I found out that not only was she loving it, but my daughter, who's 40, was loving it. And also a foreigner who was staying for the summer, who's 22-year-old male, was loving it. And I said, what is this book? So now I'm reading it, and I want to tell you, it's a wonderful little book. You can't put it down. It reads almost like a classic. And it is interesting in various ways, because it's a nice story about marriage, fatherhood, loving things. It's very tender. But it's also extraordinary because the father has an autistic son, and he and his wife go on a mission themselves to try and do something for him, and end up, it's a true book, and they end up in Mongolia, taking him to shamans, and they end up in Africa, and the boy has an affinity for horses and animals, which you know from Temple Brandon is very common amongst autistics. But the whole story is written in such a way that it is so dear, as well as being very educational and wonderful for anybody who has an autistic child or relative, that I have just loved this book.
Janet, I have to tell you, I've read that book too, and you're absolutely right. I couldn't put it down. There is also a documentary movie that's called The Horse Boy that you can get in the library, which is about the book itself. But yeah, and I think every father, especially young father, should read this book.
I agree.
Yeah, and I thank you so much for the call and the recommendation.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Janet. The book is The Horse Boy by Rupert Isaacson. And yes, it was a documentary you can watch. But even more importantly, it's a book you can read. And it's really devastating in a wonderful, heartwarming way. Keith on Facebook tells us, any Paul Auster book will suck me in. Mm-hmm. I regularly go on Auster marathons, reading multiple novels in a row. He recommends The Book of Illusions and Invisible. That's a literary fiction. And Paul Auster, I've read a couple of
very
his things,
so,
liked them
yeah.
very much. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. Thank you for that. Sue recommends, she's a retired journalist, and she recommends Double Cross, the true story of the D-Day invasion by Ben McIntyre. It takes the reader back to one of the most fascinating decades of the past military century. Again, Double Cross, the true story of the D-Day invasion by Ben McIntyre, recommended by Sue. And Sarah in Columbus sent us an email. Everybody should consider Lord Peter Wimsey, the series by Dorothy L. Sayers, especially The Nine Tailors. My wife loves all those books. She reads them all the time. I have never. What am I missing?
I don't know. I haven't read them.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, Cassie, about St. Alban, who we talked about earlier, is how is he like Evelyn Waugh?
He is compared to Evelyn Waugh and also to Oscar Wilde.
Oh, God.
But the thing is, Evelyn Waugh was like a handful of dust. I mean, that's hilarious skewering of the aristocracy. And I really think that, St. Alban has sort of taken it to another level where he's, his irony and his... it's hard for me to find the word without turning people off from it, because as some people may think it's difficult, but it's not. It's compelling reading, and I don't think that Evelyn Waugh gets down to that ugliness.
Yeah. No, he doesn't do that. But there's one of his novels, I think it's A Handful of Dust, where the first 10 pages is about one guy deciding who's he going to lunch with that day and where.
I think that's very funny with the way that's set up.
So he's great if you want a sort of a light book. But St. Alban, what I've read, is not all that light all the time, but it is very wickedly funny.
That's right.
What else do you have for us, Cassie Rose?
I think I'll talk about Juno Diaz. And I thought it was Juno, but I've listened to some of you, and it's Juno Diaz.
Juno, okay.
And I wanted to read his first collection of short stories, Drown, which came out probably about 1996 or 97, because he has a new collection coming out September 11th. And I think it's called This Is How You Lose Her, a lot of publicity coming out around it, and it's got the new book has 9 stories, and it still features the brothers that are in Drown. So I was quite taken with his writing style. He is, Juno Diaz is from the Dominican Republic. And reading his stories is, if we're going to compare, it's like reading, I would say, Knock 'em Stiff in the fact that it's culturally rich. He takes you into the life of people from the Dominican Republic who live there and also who come to New Jersey. It's not immigrant stories.
Because I've read his novel, which I thought was
The Brief Life of
The Brief Life. Yes,
yes, which he won the Pulitzer
for. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, so it's he's in their language. He's in the relationships between parents and children. He tells one story where 2 kids in the Dominican Republic are off for the summer. Their mom is working in a chocolate factory and so sends them off to live in the countryside. And they pretty much go after a young boy who has a facial deformity and who is hoping to get to New York to see the doctors. Well, then there's another story where it's from the viewpoint of that boy and is his life and how he's learning English with a local pastor and how his hopes of getting to New York. Or it's another story about the boys and how they miss their father, who is living in New York, and how they hope 2 times he's coming back, and the story about all that. And then there's another story about from the viewpoint from the father in New York, who is leading a new life, how he finds work. And so you really get wrapped up with these characters and learn about this very unique culture of those from the Dominican Republic and coming to New York, and actually mostly the characters are in New Jersey. So I'm fascinated to go on and read his new story collection and to keep with this cultural immersion. It's really fascinating, and I wouldn't say it's riveting reading. It's very interesting and compelling reading and takes you into this new world. So
I remember the novel. You have it. The title, escapes. The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, which was a great novel. And what it was about was it was both authentic and entertaining,
yes,
which is a hard combination. Mm-hmm. You don't always find that. So, and there was a whole 10 pages just about his grandmother, which was both funny and very, very moving. So, Juno Diaz, mm-hmm. Juno Diaz, we highly recommend.
And one other thing, and I don't know, in the novel, was there a lot of Spanglish?
Yes.
Which is a lot in Drown, too. So if you don't, and I don't know Spanish, so it's put me off a little bit. So I had to go up and look up some words so that I wouldn't miss the meaning of the story. Yeah. So I just sort of put that out there as a little cautionary note.
He may have made up some of the words, too, just to keep you on your toes, which
right.
I think was good. But whatever he did was very, very effective. Another book I couldn't put down. What's the longest fight, Kevin?
Oh, we had a caller earlier talking about looking at really good books on history. And normally I don't do that, but I just happened to pick this one up. It caught my eye. The Longest Fight, it's by William Gildea, who was a longtime sports writer, retired now. The Longest Fight, in the ring with Joe Gans, boxing's first African-American champion. And Joe Gans is a forgotten figure, but at one time he was probably the wealthiest boxer in America. Right at the turn of the century, he fought most of his fights right around 1902 to 1906. And he fought, of course, when they didn't have any limits on the number of rounds you fought. So he fought one of the longest, he was a middleweight, I believe, middleweight championship fights ever, 46 rounds against a guy named Battling Nelson, who was an avowed racist, a vicious racist, wrote and spoke terrible things. And it's a fascinating, of course, I'm not a big boxing fan. That didn't seem interesting to me. But just looking at sort of the cultural context of this and how Gans was able to deftly work his way through a very racist system and work it to his own advantage, earning enormous amounts of money and becoming a successful businessman, using his money to start a hotel in the Maryland area where he had grown up. He fought most of his matches out west in very small towns, because I didn't know this as well, but at the turn of the century, I don't know why we don't have this now, but the turn of the century, there was a real revolt against the sport of boxing. Congress was trying to pass all sorts of laws to curtail boxing and to make it illegal. And so it was hard for boxing promoters to find venues to have matches. I didn't know that. There was a huge movement to abolish boxing as a sport because it was so violent. So that was news to me. But what's great about this book is it's incredibly light on its feet, well-written, concise, and you get a really good slice of turn-of-the-century America and a really good look at a figure from African-American history who's long been overlooked, Joe Gann, someone I knew nothing about.
I'm not going to ask you if it ends up well, because I don't want you to give it away, but that's The Longest Fight by William Gildea, a celebrated sports writer.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like that could be a great read for really anybody.
Yes, it's a good read, not to put it down, not to dismiss it, but it is a good read if you are in the middle of one of those incredibly long, dense novels, and you're looking for something that will educate you, but you can get through, and it's very entertaining, and it'll make you think about America and the sport of boxing.
Right. I love David Foster Wallace, too, but sometimes you have to have a little fun. Fun, he's
right.
not all, he wasn't always fun, may he rest in peace.
You have to have a little palate cleanser now and then.
In our few moments, if you'd like to call 292-8513 or allsides@wosu.org, our last few moments, I had shared with you both an article about book reviews right now. And this writer is of the opinion that book reviews now are very sort of facile. They praise to the skies mediocrity, et cetera, just to sell books. It's become a complete marketing function and not an honest assessment of a book. I'm just interested in your thoughts about that.
Well, I think a lot of that is being driven by the social media arena because of Twitter and Facebook, and it's a lot of the lines are being blurred. So therefore, like for me on Twitter, I've got a lot of writers, authors that are connected to me on Twitter. They are, you know, I see writers on Facebook connecting to their audience, and the critics are involved in that too. I see the critic for the Washington Post on Twitter, and it's what happens is that the publishers then come to you, the authors come to you, they send the book. There's also that kind of activity going on in the blogosphere, and I started to certainly feel this pressure of having to be nice, and I got red flags all over the place about it and thinking the boundary line is being crossed, and I felt that in being very much smudged into a grayness. So I have become very, very careful about requesting review copies of books because of the expectation that is coming with that. I totally agree that a lot of the reviews are becoming too happy, too, isn't this a wonderful book? You can get all over the blogosphere, and publishers are fueling this. They send it to all the bloggers, and then the bloggers say, this is a great book. I gave it to my brother. He read it. He loved it. Oh, go out and read the book. But they don't critically evaluate whether or not it succeeds by the intention of what the author's intentions were, if it succeeds in plot structure and character development, if it is, you know, worthy for you to spend your time on it. All of that has just seems to be going away.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it's still there very much so with the New York Times, Sunday Book Review, the Washington Post. But there is this surging, you know, happy reviewing. And it's more in terms of publicizing the book and pushing the book and getting it purchased.
Well, Kevin said earlier the bar is lowered. When you suggested we read William Styron, Sophie's Choice, and see what a bestseller was 40 years ago
that's
in that
right.
book.
Well, both you and I read that really great novel called After the Workshop.
Oh yeah,
which was about the whole book marketing industry and I think it made a good point. It was in that book where they talked about, again, that the target page number is about 250 pages because people don't want to read beyond that. And they feel if the book is shorter, they're not getting their money's worth. So it's really interesting. I did an informal survey of all the new books in the new book section at the Whetstone Library. And if you look at a lot of the new, quote unquote, literary fiction, it's all right on the money, right around 250, 260 pages. And the new thing, too, is literary fiction, if you look at the back, it'll just be inundated with blurbs. It'll be about 10 blurbs. usually from the exact same people in many cases, one blurb after another. In fact, if I see, right now, if I see a book with a blurb by Justin Cronin on it, I just put it right back. I'm so tired of it. It's like on everything. So I worry about that. And I think Cassie made an excellent point. We always think, oh, isn't it great that we have things like Facebook and Twitter to keep us connected? But being connected is not what you want if you want to remain objective.
Yes.
That's a real problem. Mm-hmm. We want to be objective, and the more connected you are, the more likely you are to, oh, I better not say anything because I could hurt this person's feelings, or
they could
come back on me.
They could come after me, yes.
Yeah, that could come back to me. So that's why I think people are being so careful with these reviews. You wonder. And I agree. I have done the same thing. I do not request review copies anymore. I won't take them, and I won't look at them.
Well, and the disservice is coming to the readers. Because, I mean, there was one book that I was reading and I saw it was just so promoted on the Barnes & Noble, their e-newsletter. I saw it had the blurbs on the back that was just by big-name authors. And the premise of the book sounded very good. And I decided, maybe I'm interested in this. And then I was like, no, I'm going to read what the Washington Post has to say about it. And Ron Charles there completely pulled the rug out from under it and gave the full transparency there. And I'm like, I'm not going to read this book. You know, it's happened. So I try and go to the critics that are out there being objective and going to Kirkus and going to Publishers Weekly. So, but that's hard for, you know, the readers to do. They're relying
on. And conversely, the people that write bad reviews, that dislike something, the good ones tell you why they dislike it. I mean, they go to the text and things like that. The bad ones just are writing. They're very fun to read, these reviews, but they're not helpful to anybody, certainly. So I think there's a little disconnect there as well. We have time for two more emails. We got from Natalie, who recommends The White Noise by Don DeLillo, which was a big seller a number of years back. For her guilty pleasures, she enjoys a good P.G. Wodehouse book, and I go back to read her favorite from childhood, Anne of Green Gables. The latter I know. Wodehouse comes up on this program all the time, and I still haven't read any of it. I need to get with it because everybody who calls us enjoys that so much. And Antoinette from Mount Vernon recently read Seating Arrangements by Maggie Shipstead, a great work of fiction. It's insightful, witty, with great character development. It's a first novel by the 29-year-old Maggie Shipstead. She's an alumni of the famous Iowa Writers Workshop.
Just came out, I think, last month.
Have you heard about it?
Yes, it's and it got a great review in the New York Times, and actually, it's getting mixed reviews.
Okay, well, so, that's our old. Well, Antoinette liked it, and that's good enough for me. I'm delighted to hear from that. I thank everybody who called and emailed today. We had a lot of emails today, and a lot of Facebook posts as well. It's always fun to talk about books. I especially like guilty pleasures. I am not going to tell what my current guilty pleasure is because I'm embarrassed. But and I did find myself this morning at the gym hiding it on the stair so that no one saw what I was reading. But there you are. One last plug for The Sign about the Shroud of Turin by Thomas de Wesselow, which is an incredible archaeological mystery. My thanks to Kevin Griffith from Capital University, and my thanks to Cassie Rose, proprietess chatelaine of thelongestchapter.com. And WOSU's book critics. The All Sides staff includes associate producer Amy Jurevich, intern Corinne Gleckler, assistants Rachel Ramey and Letitia Wiggins, All Sides volunteer Andrew Sweet. Is this his last day, Amy Jurevich? His last day. That's why we have donuts. Good luck to Andrew Sweet, and thank you. Video production by Rich and Amber Krasminski. Alan DeCenzo is composer of our theme music. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director is Mike Thompson. Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. And I'm Christopher Purdy. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.